Today, we'll be discussing the career of actor Christina Applegate, and we'll be examining multiple sclerosis, which is the disease that she suffers from. This is Doctor versus Comedian. I'm Dr. Asif Doja, and this is the Doctor of Laughs.
Not a real doctor.
Ali Hassan. Every episode, I pick a topic for Ali from comedy and entertainment, and I question him about it. Then Ali picks a topic for medicine and health and grills me on that topic. Today, we'll be speaking about the actor Christina Applegate. Now, Christina is a breast cancer survivor who, in 2021, then announced that she was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. So we did discuss breast cancer on a previous episode, and you can check that out in our archives. So in the second half of this episode, we'll be discussing multiple sclerosis. Okay, Ali, let's get right into our discussion about Christina Applegate, actress, comedian, you know, and now, of course, we'll in our second half, we'll talk about her battle with MS, and we'll talk a bit about breast cancer as well. So,
a podcaster, too, related to her disease, right?
We should mention that. We'll talk about
before
that.
We wrap this up. Yes. Yeah.
So, let's talk a bit about her background, and then we can just kind of go through some of the things she's been involved with over time. And so she was born to Nancy Pretty, who was P-R-I-D-D-Y, who was a singer and actress, and her father was Bob Applegate, who was a producer at Dot Records, which I guess was
Nancy Pretty, by the way, appeared on Bewitched, The Waltons, and Matlock, depending on what age you are.
That is relevant. Oh, I love Matlock. Not, yeah. And then her parents separated shortly after she was born. And then afterwards, her mother had a relationship with Stephen Stills. You might know him from Crosby, Stills, and Nash, and sometimes with Young there at the end of that. And then she, I guess, was a child actor and appeared like as a baby in Days of Our Lives. Her mother was in Days of Our Lives, so she was in it as a baby. And she was also in a Playtex baby bottle commercial at 3 months of age. So I don't know if you saw that one, Holly.
I didn't even know Playtex did anything other than women's sanitary products. Playtex made baby bottles? Or they still do?
I don't know if they still do, but I think they probably do. They're just all into the plastic, you know, that kind of thing. That's their jam.
It's just play.
Yeah. Now, she made her film debut in 1981, and it was a horror film called The Jaws of Satan. So I think they're trying to...
You've seen it?
No, I haven't, but I bet you they're trying to capitalize on Rosemary's Jaws. Baby and Jaws, right? Yeah, we put Jaws and Satan together. Yes, exactly.
Absolutely. It's classic Hollywood formula there.
But I think most people know her from Married with Children, right, Ali?
Yes, and it feels a little bit like I don't want to be accused of, like, punching somebody when they're down. She is – the straws she's drawn right now in life are very, very difficult. I just want to be honest that I really didn't like that character and I really didn't like that show. But I think also my dislike for her continued for a number of years, and so much so that I kind of forgot that she was a human being who played a role. And I think that speaks to how well she played that role. Like, she was very convincing, and it was also 10 years, and it was in an era where we didn't have a lot of channels. So Married with Children, which I didn't even watch very often, but it was just kind of on. And then it was even in syndication, so it was on more after the 10-year run. It was just always around. So, you know, with so few channels, it probably occupied 1/5 of my brain, that show, even though I maybe – if I tell you I've watched 20 episodes of that show, that might be an exaggeration.
Well, I think this – happens sometimes when people have a breakout role, right? Because you don't know if that's how they are really or if they're actually acting, right? You will only know that with subsequent roles. And of course, Christina Applegate has definitely proven that she is a, you know, very, very talented actor. So I think it's hard to know at the beginning. Married with Children is an interesting series because you have to go back in time to think about when it came out, right? It came out at the time of Cosby Show, Family Ties, Growing Pains, all these, like, you know, ideal depictions of families on yeah. television. And then you have this family where, like, you know, the dad hates everybody, the mom's ditz, the daughter's a sex pot, the son's a jerk, you know? Like, you have all these things that are very different than what was going on in TV. So it was very out there and kind of cutting edge almost for the late 80s and early 90s when it came out. So you have to kind of think about it in its own context.
Yeah, I think I was, you know, not appreciating it in that context at all, but you have to give it, you know, there's something to be said. Now, I remember thinking, like, this is what Americans like. And I remember this was like feeding my anti-American propaganda that lived in my brain at the time. But it did run for 10 years. And this is called a live action sitcom. It was the longest, it is to this day, the longest running live action sitcom that Fox has ever aired. So pretty impressive run from that regard. Yeah, they did all right. They did all right for themselves. There was like comic books. There's a board game, right. Action figures. I mean, you know, this thing really, they eked out every bit. They milked all they could out of this thing.
And then afterwards, she kind of got into doing some movies. She was in Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead. That was 1991. I think, I don't know if I've seen that. I remember it coming out, but I don't know if I ever saw that. And then she's done a couple TV roles after that. She was in, I kind of alternated between TV and movies. So she was in Jesse, which she won a People's Choice Award for and was nominated for a Golden Globe. In 2004, she was in the Ben Affleck comedy Surviving Christmas. So, you know, she's kind of been always doing something. But then I remember when she appeared in the 9th and 10th seasons of Friends. And she basically played Rachel's sister. And she played Amy Green, who was Rachel Green's sister. Of course, played by Jennifer Aniston. And then, of course, Christina Applegate won the Primetime Emmy Award for Outstanding Guest Actress in a Comedy Series for her performance in the one with Rachel's other sister. So that was pretty...
I know nothing about this. As we've said on this podcast, by season 9 and 10, I was no longer interested in Friends. I was not going to go down with that sinking ship. I had a life, Asif, right?
It was like the number one show.
I know. I don't know. I just lost interest. I just was like, there's too many things happening here. It's sort of like The Office, one of the greatest shows that I've ever watched. And then after a while, I'm like, man, even though I love Will Ferrell, I'm like, I'm not following it.
After Steve Carell leaves, that show sucks. The show just ended there. We all know that.
I
know that.
And in Friends, once the monkey was no longer on the show, there should be no Friends anymore. I kid. Asif rolled his eyes. He's very particular about his Friends tribute.
Best guest actor in a comedy series, incidentally, guys, is what Ali is nominated for at the Canadian Screen Awards, yes. Which are coming up in May, right?
They are coming up in May. That's right.
Yeah. He doesn't promote himself, but I have to promote him. You're nominated for 2 awards, right?
I am nominated for 2 awards, best guy who shows up and best like a lead type of thing.
Best guy who wandered into the frame.
Yeah,
excellent.
Yeah. And those are like, you know what's nice about that? I was just thinking about that, even though I wasn't going to mention it, but I was just thinking about that because those are roles, you know, in one I play a grandfather who is like a bit of a curmudgeon, but also trying his best to be like loving and understanding. Mm-hmm. And then the other, I play an uncle with this trans, you know, I can't even figure it out at first, niece, nephew, how do I address this trans person who is my relative? And also somebody who becomes quite like soft-hearted. So out there in the streets, people are going to see me. They're going to be like, you're a soft-hearted guy, right? I could have been playing a sex maniac, but instead a soft-hearted grandfather.
Well, I think it speaks to the fact that on both the shows that you're on, the writers really tried to make your character well-rounded.
Yeah. And those shows are, by the way, Sort Of and Run the Burbs, which I don't think we mentioned.
By the way, do you want to mention who you're nominated against in these categories? It's some big actors. Oh, my God.
That's why I don't even mention. I mean, this is a real honor to be nominated type of situation in that, you know, sort of best guest role. I'm opposite Dan Aykroyd, Jan Arden. For our American listeners, I'm not sure if a massive, massive Canadian star. Jay Baruchel and Mae Martin, whose career is just on fire right now. So an honor to be nominated is something that I believe and will repeat.
Are you going to go to the awards?
I am going to go to the awards. Would I not want to be rejected in person? Again, it's not a rejection. It is an honor to be nominated. You know, when getting back to the show at hand here, when I rediscovered Christina Applegate was in Anchorman. Mm-hmm. And in the movie Anchorman, she plays pretty much the opposite of Kelly Bundy. Exactly. She's a very, like, you know, self-actualized feminist, and she's opposite, like, the most misogynist, chauvinistic pigs played by, you know, Will Ferrell, Steve Carell, these guys, Paul Rudd, they're maniacs. And she, I don't know, I was like, I know this is just completely fiction, but it also speaks to, you know, all of these sort of male-dominated industries. And I know this is comedy, but there was something real, and like her frustrations were really like palpable, even though the, you know, Anchorman is this goofy, silly comedy. But for me, that was the return of Christina Applegate into my sort of viewing world.
Yeah.
And it's been sort of an uphill climb since then.
Yeah, me too. And really kind of enjoying her acting and her comedic timing. I mean, obviously, I think all of us love Anchorman. And did you see, Ali, as an aside, Wake Up Ron Burgundy, the lost movie?
No. Where would I watch that? And should I?
It's very interesting. So what happens is, and I'm kind of shortening this whole story, but basically, Anchorman, they did a lot of improv, right? That was the whole way that they do it. But they had a whole second half of the movie where there's like an evil villain, and they go to the evil villain's lair, and there's all this stuff. And they filmed all of it. So there's a whole part of this movie, which is basically like another movie that you could watch, which is completely different. Like, it has zero overlap with the second half of Anchorman.
And well, that's very funny, because I've always said that Anchorman itself, the real Anchorman, also has a second half of movie that is completely out of line with it. Right? Right. When they go to war, Ben Stiller's crew shows up, Vince Vaughn's crew. I don't remember who. There was like all these crews that show up, and they have like a street fight.
Yeah.
I mean, that's insane. Which is the best scene
in the movie, but but anyway, you should watch this. I think I saw it online somehow, whether it's like YouTube or somewhere else. It's easy enough to find, but basically you're getting a whole other hour of an Anchorman movie that you've never seen before that has zero overlap with the original movie. So,
and what is it called? Anchorman World?
It's called Wake Up Ron Burgundy, : The Lost Movie.
Oh.
And colon the punctuation.
It has nothing to do with the word Anchorman. The words Anchorman are not even in it.
No.
Okay.
So anyway, check that out. That's a little bit of trivia for you guys. Of course, Christina Applegate is in that alternate movie as well. And then she did Samantha Who, which was an ABC comedy. I remember this coming out. I don't know if I watched it, but I remember thinking the premise was so interesting. It's about a 30-year-old who, after a hit-and-run accident, develops amnesia and has to rediscover her life. She got Emmy nominations for that, Golden Globe nominations for that. So again, like, you could see, like, everything she's coming out with, there's usually a critical acclaim, nominations, you know, for her.
And also, I don't know if there's any way to find Samantha Who anywhere, but Jean Smart, right, from Hacks, phenomenal actor.
Yeah.
Jennifer Esposito from 1,000 different things and over the years, terrific dramatic and comedic actor. And Melissa McCarthy, three of them, I don't remember that. That's crazy.
Yeah.
How do I not remember? These are, I would love to watch Samantha Who.
Yeah, for sure. After that, she did The Rocker. Now, I've never seen The Rocker. What's that all about?
Well, that's weird that you haven't seen The Rocker. Were you a fan of The Office? Did you like Dwight Schrute?
I did. Yeah, Dwight. Yeah, Rainn Wilson. Yeah, I think it is good. I think, I'm not sure I was ready to watch a movie with Rainn Wilson in it as a starring character.
So that's why I'm curious. I think that is a prevailing sentiment. For fans of The Office and fans of School of Rock comes The Rocker. I mean, I just made that up. I don't know if that's written anywhere, but I thought he did a good job. Now, mind you, I watched it last year. Okay, I'm very far behind, but Emma Stone, Jane Lynch, you know, Rainn Wilson, Josh Gad, Jeff Garlin, Sudeikis, there's these cameos by Will Arnett, Sudeikis, and Fred Armisen. Bradley Cooper as well. This is a movie where they talk about Bradley being like, I think I want a long arm tattoo. And everybody was like, very smart rookie. So he was in the makeup chair at 5 a.m. while everyone else was in the makeup chair at 7 a.m. It's a crazy cast that, and Christina Applegate is third billing on it. She plays a big role, and I enjoyed it for what it is, right? What do you think you're getting with a Rainn Wilson comedy? Mm-hmm, you're getting something silly and goofy, and we definitely got that. It was good.
After that, she voiced, of course, Brittany, who's one of the Chipettes in the Alvin and the Chipmunks sequel called The Squeakquel. And then she was in the subsequent movie. So, of course.
I do think the words, of course, were not necessary there. I think you're just adding that for no reason.
I've seen all these movies because of my kids, so I've definitely seen her in that. Of course, kids, it is quotes. Weird because, of course, they alter her voice to sound like a chipmunk, so you can't even tell it's Christina Applegate, but
yeah,
it's worth spending the money. But I'm not the producer of those movies, so whatever.
It's name recognition. It's name recognition, so, right? Yeah. If you say... Johnny Wakanda is playing some of the people like, I don't know him. That's not fun.
Yeah, more embarrassing for David Cross, who appears in it live action as an actual human, you know? So, but anyway, yeah. that's another aside. So she then in 2011 was in the sitcom Up All Night. So Christina
Applegate, quite fondly.
Will Arnett and Maya Rudolph, like three hilarious people. And I watched both seasons of this show with my wife. It was a fun show. It was kind of like Will Arnett and Christina Applegate's character were new parents. It's not kind of like they actually were in the show. They had a new baby. And then, of course, Christina's character is trying to juggle work and home life. And Maya Rudolph plays her boss, who's kind of like an Oprah-type character. I think they changed everything in the second season. So they kind of threw out a lot of plot points and brought in new ones. So it didn't really last that long. It was a typical show which has like three great actors and was looking for a really good premise or hook, and I don't think it ever found it. But when I was watching that, I'm like, Christina Applegate is a charismatic comedic actress, full stop.
Yes. Also, that show was produced by Lorne Michaels. Little trivia there for you. And it also stars a guy who I really like. His name is Matt Bronger. I don't know if you know Matt Bronger as a comedian, but he played one of the next door neighbors. Will Forte is also in there. There's a bunch of Megan Mullally. Sean Hayes plays a role. You know, it had all the hallmarks of something that was going to be successful, and I'm not sure why it didn't last, but I enjoyed it for what it was as well. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then, of course, she was in the sequel to Vacation, to National Lampoon's Vacation with Ed Helms. I guess I didn't see these movies, but I guess Rusty Griswold is like grown up in this and then she plays his wife.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, you know, I don't know what your thoughts are on the original Vacation, but it's tough shoes to fill, I think. It's like, you know, Chevy Chase at his best playing Clark Griswold. How can I forget Clark? I was raised by that man, for God's sake. It's like an institution, right? So we always like take a crap on some of these remakes and redos and all this kind of stuff. This is like, it's a bit risky business, but I thought they both did a great job, both Ed Helms and of course, Christina Applegate. And again, it goes to your thing about like sort of cementing her as a great comedic actress. We knew it already prior to Vacation, but I thought this was good. I thought you did a great job because I don't know if you remember that, but it's like you're always on as the two parents in the movie Vacation. Whoever's doing it, whether you're the OG Griswolds or subsequent generations, it's insanity constantly. So it's like, from my perspective, as far as the comedic acting goes, it demands a lot of you to constantly be having a reaction to something insane that's happening. And I thought she did a great job.
And more comedy after that. She was in Bad Moms with Mila Kunis, Kristen Bell, Katherine Hahn. But then she kind of takes this kind of detour in 2018. It's more of a dark comedy dramatic series, Dead to Me, this Netflix series with Linda Cardellini.
Yeah. Linda Cardellini, by the way, you know, not a household name, but one of those people when you see her, you're like, I know her from somewhere. You probably know her from, because she's been in some of the Avengers Endgame, Avengers Age of Ultron.
Yeah, she was played Hawkeye's wife.
But yeah,
she's been
in, I know like, her Freaks from Freaks and Geeks.
Yeah, I was going to say Freaks and Geeks. She was in Mad Men. I mean, she's been in everything. I think she was in ER. Like, she's had a huge career over the past, you know, 20 or 30 years.
Yeah, go talk about her a little bit just to reinforce the fact that Christina Applegate is so good and always able to surround herself with some of the best. And I think she has to. James Marsden is also in this show, in Dead to Me, and he also does like a pretty phenomenal job. I think she surrounds herself with some of the best. It uplifts her as well, and she does great work.
So you've seen all of Dead to Me?
I've seen all of Dead to Me, loved it from the first episode. Watched that first episode, my wife and I were like, oh, we're in. We have a new show, right? You know, sometimes that can go either way. We always watch a first episode and we're like, I don't know. You can watch that on your own. You know, you get permission to quote unquote cheat on your partner. This one was like, this is our show. We're going to definitely watch it. If you like, you know, it's got this, as far as genres go, it spans a few different things, a dark comedy, a crime drama as well. And then there's another genre called tragicomedy, which it definitely straddles. Yeah, I thought it was well done. And if you haven't seen Dead to Me and you're looking for a show to watch with a partner or without, I think if those type of genres appeal to you, I think you would like it. And again, Asif, speaking about what you said, 4 nominations, again, Primetime Emmy Awards, Outstanding Comedy Series, Outstanding Lead Actress for both Christina Applegate and Cardellini. So it's like huge.
Mm-hmm. I think we've made it pretty clear that I think Christina Applegate's career has proven her to be like a world-class comedic and now dramatic actress. I don't think people can disagree with that.
Not after what we said, they can't.
Nope. So then we have to transition into some of her medical issues. So in 2008, she was diagnosed with breast cancer. And at that time, a representative said that she was diagnosed with an early stage of breast cancer, detected through a doctor-ordered MRI. The cancer was not felt to be life-threatening, but, you know, she ended up having a double mastectomy, even though the cancer was found only in one breast. And one of the reasons which we can infer that she made that decision is because she has the BRCA1 mutation, which we talked about on our previous episode, can trigger breast cancer and ovarian cancer. And her mother is a breast cancer survivor. So now you have a family history plus this gene. I think she probably, in consultation with her doctors, felt this was the best course of action to just have the double mastectomy. And so she's been doing well from all accounts from a breast cancer point of view. But then she announced in 2021 that she received this diagnosis of multiple sclerosis. This affected her ability to perform in the final season of Dead to Me. And she really credits the showrunner and Linda Cardellini with helping her get through that final season. And she said now that she probably will no longer act on camera because of the effects of the disease. She has recently, and this is why you've probably seen her in the news over the past few months, she just started a podcast with Jamie Lynn Sigler. And Jamie Lynn Sigler, you probably know from The Sopranos, right?
She played Meadow on The Sopranos, Tony Soprano's daughter. She has had MS since she was 20.
Yeah.
And she's in her early 40s at this point. So yeah, both of these women are, I mean, I'm sure this is such a useful podcast for people who have MS to just hear, you know, the fact that you're not alone and the struggles that people go through. But I think it would be, even if you don't have MS, I think it's a really, what a valuable, why don't we do a proper valuable, no, I think it's a very valuable podcast to have out there.
Well, we are about to do that in the next section. And just, but go. A quick plug for her podcast and Jamie Lynn's podcast is called Messy, M-E-S-S-Y, but you can capitalize the M and the first S, like MS. Get it? Because MS is a messy disease in the words of, and your life living with it is messy, in quotation marks, as per Christina Applegate and Jamie Lynn Sigler. So check that out for sure, but stay tuned for our next session because we're going to be going in depth into MS.
Hey, guess what? It's our next section.
Oh, huh? Good. Already. I was surprised, yeah.
We are going to go into MS. There's some very interesting and curious stuff about MS that I know from, you know, a cursory perspective, not in depth, but I grew up, one of my close friends growing up, his mother was the first person to contract?
I mean, to be diagnosed with it. I don't know. It's not like an infectious disease.
Right. His mother was the first person that I knew, and she would have been in her late 40s, early 50s. She was diagnosed with it, and we didn't really know what that meant. I don't think they fully knew what that meant, but we watched her with great curiosity just to see what level of, you know, sort of mobility she continued to have. And I think that's not necessarily illustrative, because different forms of MS or different people will react to it a different way, and it can be much more aggressive and much lighter with other people. So that's kind of what I wanted to dig into also. Like, what does it mean? Where does it come from? How does it affect people differently? And what does a diagnosis mean? As we said, Jamie Lynn Sigler diagnosed at age 20 and is 42 and, still around, I assume, you know, somewhat able to talk about, somewhat mobile and able to talk about, whereas Christina Applegate, diagnosed 2 years ago, is already walking with a cane, is no longer going to be able to act. In Dead to Me, there were scenes where she talks about her sound tech, who's also a close friend of hers, having to sort of hold her legs up in a scene to where the, you know, they have to block her on the camera up and she can't really stand anymore. So he's like wrapped around her legs, holding her. And I mean, yeah, the pace at which this disease can ravage your body is so frightening. So let's get into the first thing, which is, what is MS? What does it mean?
Right. So this is a neurologic disease, and it's an immune-mediated inflammatory disease. So you get inflammation because of an immune attack on your brain. And what happens is you get immune attack on specific areas which are called myelinated axons. So axons are these kind of cables in our brain that connect our brain. So we have our neurons in our brain. These are the areas where we will, if we want to think about something, so me thinking about talking right now, me moving my arm, those are all start in your neurons, which are in your what we call gray matter, kind of at the surface of the brain, sort of. And then we have these cables that connect it down, and it goes all the way down to other parts of your brain and your spinal cord. So in fact, all of these axons in our brain, which are these cables, have a coating around them called myelin. And myelin is like an insulation, right? It's like insulation, the rubber insulation around a cable, like electrical cable, right? And so you get attack on this myelin from your immune system. So your immune system is making a mistake. It's not attacking a virus or a bacteria. It's attacking your myelin and breaking that down. And you can imagine, just like if it's electric cable and you affect the insulation around it, you're going to affect the signals being carried through an electric cable. And that's what happens. And it happens, again, in the brain and spinal cord. So we call that the central nervous system when we're talking about the brain and spinal cord. So that's what it is.
I should remind people that, you know, for our new listeners, especially, Asif is a pediatric neurologist. So this is like something, sadly, that you're very familiar with, because it does also happen in kids. But we'll get to that in a second. Let's talk about how common it is.
Yeah, and I can address what you just said too. So it usually is diagnosed in patients between 15 and 45 years. So we're talking about lots of teenagers who will get it as well. But it can actually occur in any age. Average age of diagnosis is 29 in women and 31 in men. And at any given point, let's say in the US, there will be 58 to 95 people per 100,000 who have this disease. It affects about 2.1 million people in the world. In kids, and I was actually involved in some of this research in Canada with some collaborators in different centers, the incidence in kids is about 1 per 100,000. So not that uncommon, you know, because you think, oh, MS would be so unusual. But brain tumors occur in about 1 in 100,000 or 200,000. So you would never say, oh, a brain tumor. I've never heard of a kid with a brain tumor. That seems true. Of course you have, right? That's not the most uncommon thing in the world. So it's about as common as that. So you have to think about it as a possible disease, really, in any age group, even though there are some peaks.
What causes it? I ask reluctantly.
So, as usual, we don't know what causes it.
For usual.
We think that you have a genetic susceptibility. This is what people think. And of course, the research is always ongoing. There's a genetic susceptibility, but it's not 100% genetic, because we know that monozygotic twins, which means identical twins, the concordance rate is only 20 to 30%. So only 20 to 30% of identical twins will each have MS. So it's not purely genetic, but there has to be a genetic component, right? Because yeah. otherwise you just assume it'd be the general population risk, right? And then there's a presumed predisposition with a non-genetic trigger. What that trigger is, we don't know, but we can talk about some possibilities. So is it a viral infection? Some people have implicated Epstein-Barr virus, and Epstein-Barr virus is associated with mononucleosis, when people get mono. And so maybe that, and maybe the age you get that, maybe primes your immune system, you know? This is still not clear, or maybe some other infection. And then the thing is, though, you don't just get one immune attack. You get recurrent immune attacks. And that is part of what MS is these recurrent attacks. And the other possibility, which is interesting, is, you know, does geography or vitamin D levels associate?
Yeah, geography is something I wanted to dive into because I've read that in Canada and in the US, but I was reading about Canada, you have a higher rate of MS than in other places in the world. So that's definitely worth talking about. Tell me about the geography and
So
the geography is linked to the vitamin D.
Well, that's what people think. It's a possibility. So let's talk about that. So very interesting that the disease is more common in the southernmost and northernmost regions of the world. And it's less common in equatorial regions. So the question is, what is that? What is the reason for why we see this? It's very unusual that it's geography dependent. So then you think about what things. So when you think about it, they think the effect, it must exert itself in early childhood, because if you live in an area with low incidence of MS, so equatorial, up until age 15, you remain low risk even when you move to an area of high incidence. So if you live around the equator and then you move to Canada, as long as it's before age 15, you will keep that low risk. Okay. Hmm. But there's also some other ethnic groups who live in areas of higher incidence that don't have a higher frequency of MS. And a good example is, it's funny, in the article I was reading, it calls them Eskimos, which nobody calls this group of people Eskimos anymore. It's like,
when was that article written? Term.
I know. I think it maybe was an American article. And they're like, yeah, sure. I think we still call them that. You don't know anything. Anyway, I'm talking about Inuit persons. They don't have a higher frequency of MS despite living in the far north, right? So there's geography, there's genetics. How is this interplay going on? But one hypothesis is that it has to do with vitamin D levels, as that being an environmental factor contributing to the development of MS, because you will have lower vitamin D levels because of lower sunlight exposure when you live at higher latitudes, right? And I take vitamin D every day because, especially if you're dark skinned, you're going to have lower vitamin D levels living in Canada. You just will. Like, it's almost impossible to have good levels. So that may be a possibility. So a lot of work is being done to look into the role of vitamin D in MS. It's also interesting because there are certain areas that, even though they're in a northern latitude, they have a lower incidence of MS, and despite having limited sunlight. So Norway, and it could be because of their traditional diets, which are high in vitamin D, may give them a protective effect. So there is a lot to be thought about how vitamin D, and so like I said, I think it makes sense for many reasons, not necessarily to prevent MS, but just, you know, for your bone health and everything, to just take vitamin D. That's my opinion.
So let's talk about the symptoms of MS and talk about, you know, when it's time to maybe visit a doctor because you have actual concerns and how it manifests. And also getting back to my original thing about why some people can have MS for 25 years, mm-hmm. and some people can have it for two and sort of wind up in the mm-hmm. same situation.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. So you have to go back to the name of MS, which is multiple sclerosis. So sclerosis are these areas of the brain, these lesions that you get in your brain or spinal cord. We call them plaques, MS plaques. Again, not the plaque that is on your teeth. And it's also not the plaque that's in your heart that causes heart attacks. And so it's completely different from those two things. So why do we use the same term?
Ran out of words in the old medical industry. Exactly. There, huh?
But it's multiple. So you have to have multiple of these areas involved. And so we say the key to the diagnosis of MS is lesions that are disseminated in time and space. So when I first heard that, when I was like a medical student or resident, I'm like, ooh, it sounds like Star Trek.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Science fiction.
No.
But you got excited.
What they mean is, so usually after the first attack, if you've had an attack, you need to wait for, this was historically, you need to wait for another attack to prove that you've had what's called dissemination time. So you'd need to have two separate attacks separated by a period of time. You also needed to have two separate attacks disseminated in space. But by space, they mean the different spaces in your brain and spinal cord. Okay, so you have to have multiple attacks affecting different areas of the brain and spinal cord. And it's this autoimmune demyelination, this attack on the myelin sheaths. So that's traditionally how we would diagnose this, with these multiple attacks. Now, it can affect anywhere in the brain or spinal cord, so it can really cause any neurologic symptom. Okay, so what would be examples of that? One of the common ones is something called optic neuritis, because it affects the nerve that goes to your eye, or actually it's coming from your eye and going into your brain. That's actually the direction the pathway goes. And that has a myelin sheath as well. So you can get attack on that, what's called the optic nerve. So you can get vision loss in one eye. Sometimes it can be painful, sometimes it's not painful. And one key thing for all these different symptoms we'll talk about is the attack has to be longer than 24 hours. So if you just lose vision in your eye for a few seconds or a few minutes, that wouldn't be an MS attack. You'd have to be longer than 24 hours. You can have problems with your balance, problems with your vision, like coordinating your eyes in terms of them moving together. So you could get double vision. You could have numbness or tingling. You could have weakness. You could have, if it affects your spinal cord, you could have an inability to go to the bathroom, like, you know, having continence, difficulty walking. There's so many different things. But the key is you have an attack that happens for 24 hours or longer. And then perhaps you have another one later on. The issue as well is that there's some other symptoms that can be commonly seen if you have a diagnosis of MS. So about 50 to 60% of people describe fatigue as one of their most prevalent and bothersome symptoms. And you can also have cognitive dysfunction. So, you know, slowing in your thinking, slowing in your mentation, and that can occur in almost 50% as well, sometimes more. And so definitely, I think most people, if they had a symptom like this, whether it's numbness or tingling or vision loss going over 24 hours, they would probably go to the emergency room or see their doctor, I'm hoping. But these would be the warning kind of things that maybe it could be an MS attack.
You may have answered this, but you may not have.
May not.
Because I still don't get it. Why are different people affected in different ways by MS?
Yeah. So there are different kinds of MS, and I'll try and simplify this a bit. The most common form is this relapsing remitting form, where you just have these discrete attacks. Then you could treat those. We'll talk about treatment in a second. And then you may go back to baseline. You may not. You may have residual problems after the attack, and then you will have another attack later on, and then you treat that. So that's a relapsing remitting form of MS. That's by far the vast majority of people. So one of the things to keep in mind is you could have an attack and then be okay afterwards, or you can have an attack and left with problems afterwards that may not recover. And so that's why two people, if we're talking about Jamie Lynn and Christina, they can both have MS, but if one of them recovered from their attack well, or their attacks well, and one didn't, that could be why you have these issues. But it's more complicated than that, because there's also progressive forms of MS. Some people can start off with a progressive form, whereas other people have these ups and downs, these relapsing and remitting episodes, and then they start to progress. So that means you acquire neurologic disability over time, despite not having attacks. You're just going about your day, and as time goes on, the weeks and months, you're getting more and more problems. So problems with walking, problems with talking, problems with your sensation. Like I said, it could affect anywhere. And so why someone converts to being progressive, why you may start off being progressive and not start off with those attacks, we don't know the reasons why. And I don't know, maybe Christina Applegate will talk about this, which form she has and how things have evolved for her in her podcast. So definitely you should tune into her podcast to see, but I don't know the answer to that for her. But this is why you can have different people with different manifestations.
Okay. How do you test for it?
So the best test is MRI scan. And it used to be years ago, like when I was back in training and residency, you'd have to do an initial MRI. And if you saw these lesions, which are lesions that if you look at an MRI in a certain sequence, they all appear bright, like bright white, and you can see them scattered throughout the brain, you'd want to repeat it in a few months to see if new lesions occurred. Remember that dissemination in time and space, right? To see if new lesions occurred. Now, because of the different criteria that are now used, you can sometimes diagnose MS on the first attack with the first MRI by looking at different patterns of the MRI and whether the gadolinium, which is the contrast they give, if that enhances lesions, that can also help give a clue. You can also check the spinal fluid and look for something called oligoclonal bands. We don't really to get into that, but it's an immune kind of reaction. And that is found in 70 to 90% of patients with MS. So probably those two things, MRI, maybe a spinal tap, is usually quite good. There are a few things that exist that can kind of mimic MS, but in general, it's pretty clear from a neurologist's point of view if someone has MS or not.
Before we talk about MS treatments, I did want to go back to something I asked, which is, when should you be concerned about possibly having something that doctors should look at? Because you mentioned fatigue, but fatigue is like...
Yeah, exactly.
You know, there's like 1% of the population left who don't experience some level of fatigue that they can't explain. Yeah, you know, you're like, I don't know why I'm tired. I slept well. So what do we do to not make ourselves super paranoid?
Yeah, so not just fatigue, not just cognitive problems. That would be very unusual. The way I would explain it, say you were like a resident working with me, I'm like, you need hard neurologic findings. So what do I mean by hard neurologic findings? Vision loss, weakness, inability to walk, loss of bowel, bladder control, sensory changes. Those are the ones that could probably be the most subtle. If out of all those things, I think the other things people would know, I can't walk, I'm going to the hospital. But like a sensory change, like a numbness that's persisting for over 24 hours, that's probably the one that could be a bit harder to know. Is this something? Is this nothing? Could it be carpal tunnel? Like maybe it's not MS, you know, it could be something else. So that's probably the one where I'm like, you should probably get checked out if you've had symptoms that's been lasting a couple of days. And if they're like a numbness kind of tingling, probably get checked out at least by your family doctor and then see anything else that's more serious than that. I would suggest you just go to the emergency room. So it's these quote unquote hard findings, something like fatigue or decrease in your cognition. Those wouldn't be enough to get worried about MS right away.
Okay. All right. So let's talk about the treatment. What are we left with here?
Yeah, so you can treat it for sure. So if you have an acute attack, so coming in with a new onset of weakness, usually we give people corticosteroids. So again, these are anti-inflammatory steroids, not bodybuilding steroids. And that will speed up the recovery in patients who get those. Of course, there's side effects for steroids, so we don't want people on those long term. There's other options. You can do something called plasmapheresis, where you basically filter out the bad antibodies. You can also sometimes give something called IVIG, which is giving people extra antibodies. And how that works is a bit complicated and still unclear, but I always say, which is not true, it mops up the bad antibodies when you're giving somebody good antibodies. But that's not actually how it works, but that's how I rationalize it in my mind when I'm thinking about it. So there is ways to treat the acute attacks. Again, you may be treated for the attack and still be left with symptoms. We cannot tell that just when you're coming in. And we try as hard as we can to treat it, but it's very hard to know whether that's going to do the trick or not. And obviously, if you're diagnosed with MS, we try and treat the symptoms, whether it's fatigue, cognitive problems. You can get something called spasticity, which is a tightness in your limbs. You can treat that. And rehab and physiotherapy and using things like assisted devices like canes, and we can do. But what we're trying to do is try these disease-modifying agents. So these are medicines that you take on a regular basis, sometimes daily, sometimes weekly. Some of them are injections, some of them are infusions, some of them are pills, but it's to prevent relapses and ideally to prevent you accruing disability over time. There's a lot of those. I'm probably not going to get into all the different types, and there's always new ones coming on board that can be used. And so the MS specialist, the reason why, remember I said that you used to have multiple attacks to be diagnosed, but now they're diagnosing it on just one MRI, and that's changed since I was in residency, is because people want to get patients on treatment as soon as possible. because they don't want them to have more and more and more attacks and accrue more and more disability. So that's the goal. And then they'll do follow-up MRIs to see how they're doing and things like that. And so, like I said, going on a disease-modifying agent early is what people want to do. The other things to talk about is there is some scientific evidence for getting stem cell transplants or bone marrow transplants in patients with multiple sclerosis, so really severe patients, you may have to do that. And then the question is, what about vitamin D that we talked about? Mm-hmm. So I would say a lot of MS experts just immediately will just put someone on vitamin D, you know, just to take that out of the equation and just say, just take this, you know.
Is there an amount associated with that, or it depends on what level of MS they have?
Yeah, so I'll just say what they say on the MS Canada website. So they say for adults and children, so we'll say 9 to 70 years old, they say the recommended daily intake is 600 international units. And they also tell you the maximum is 4,000 international units because some people will want to take more. Adults over 70 years old, it's a bit higher. It's 800 international units. So a lot of people like, I think I take a supplement that has 1,000, you know. So some people take 1,000, 1,500, 2,000. As long as you're not going over the maximum daily intake, I think it's fine. But that's what it says on the MS Canada website.
What is the prognosis for the disease?
Yeah, so I think it's important to treat it because if it's left untreated, 30% of patients will develop significant physical disability within 20 to 25 years of onset. So I think that's why we're trying to be more and more aggressive. And one of the sad things, and again, why we're trying to be aggressive in kids as well, is because it's 20 to 25 years after onset, right? So because of that, that onset will occur, of course, earlier in a younger patient, right? Because if you're 30 or 40 and you get it, you may only have significant disability in your 60s or 70s. But if you get it when you're, and I have seen kids as young as 5 or 6 years old who got MS, then over time, they're going to develop this disability, but when they're still young adults, right? And then, of course, a longer life lived with disability. So it is important to try and be relatively aggressive in trying to control the relapses. So that's our episode for today. Let us know what you guys thought about our discussion of Christina Applegate and MS. Anything we missed on reviewing the career of Christina Applegate. And there are other topics in MS that we should talk about. Again, we could talk about the pediatrics and how it's different maybe than adults with MS. And there's also some newer diseases which can be MS mimics. So one is neuromyelitis optica. One is also anti-MOG disease. So these are kind of newer things that if you guys are interested, I'm happy to talk about because we see these in patients not uncommonly as neurologists, so we can definitely talk about those or any other subjects you want to talk about. drvcomedian@gmail.com, drvcomedian on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. We are everywhere. It's called X, but you know,
yeah, it's a cesspool no matter what you call it. You know exactly. What I mean, but if you're on it, so are we. Don't forget, we appreciate those 5-star reviews. We appreciate you sharing news about this podcast with people. We get a lot of texts and messages and emails about things people loved in the episodes. And the first thing I always want to say is thank you for that. And thank you for sharing that. But the second thing I always want to say is let somebody know, let a couple of people know about the podcast so we can grow this thing and grow this network that we have.
Absolutely. Yeah. Anybody, you know, listen to podcasts, just mention to our podcast and tell them to check it out. Ellie, anything you got going on the next couple of months?
You mentioned that I'm nominated for those awards, Canadian Yes. Screen Awards. The Canadian Screen Awards are at the end of May for about 5 days, different categories, different things going on. If you're in the Toronto area and you're interested in entertainment, Canadian Screen Awards are something you can look up and enjoy. And besides that, standupali.com is the website. And my activities, those that I like to share, those that you want to hear about are up there.
Sounds good, Ali. But remember that although I'm a doctor, I'm not your doctor. Medical issues we talk about are for your interest and information only, and they're not medical advice. Please consult your medical professionals for actual medical advice. Thanks for listening.
Bye-bye. We'll be right back.
Bye.